Blog Talk Radio.
Who is January Jones? She is not a young, beautiful, talented actress on Mad Men. She is not an older, gorgeous, exotic dancer from the Johnny Carson show. She is an author, and she wrote Thou Shall Not Whine, the 11th commandment, that reached number one at Amazon.com. She is a reality TV golf personality with World High Stakes Golf televised on HDNet. She is a humorist and winologist expert. She is your featured host today on January Jones Sharing Success Stories. So sit back, relax, and get ready to laugh and listen to Ms. Jones with her eclectic roster of guests as you learn life's lessons. These stories plus sharing equals success. Welcome, and remember, beware, because you are entering the no-whining world of January Jones.
Now let me ask you a question. Can you imagine writing about your life growing up? Can you imagine doing it in Southern California? I mean, growing up and writing it about it too. Have you ever heard about a town named Hawthorne, California? Can you imagine having a love-hate relationship with the Catholic Church? Well, I sure can imagine it, and I've experienced it. Tell me, have you ever heard about an amazing book called The Eight-Fingered Criminal Son? Or would you like to visit The Spirit Bar Guide? Now, would you like to meet someone who has some of the answers that you've been looking for? Now, are you ready to learn how to be successful in Hawthorne, California? If you can answer yes or maybe to any of these questions, then you are in the right place. And I would like to welcome you to January Jones Sharing Success Stories. Today, I will be introducing you to my guest, who is a writer extraordinaire. He will provide us with wonderful, informative, and inspirational lessons and some really, really great advice. And I think he'll be very amusing. I'm pleased to announce that our show now has over 1.7 million listeners to date. Also, LinkedIn has announced that my profile was one of the top 5% most viewed during 2012. Now, let me tell you a little bit about my guest today. He was born in Inglewood, California in 1960 and raised by a single mom in a working-class neighborhood called Hawthorne, California. He grew up on the same street as the Beach Boys. How interesting. He attended Catholic grade school and public high school. After graduation, my guest joined the United States Air Force. 5 months later, he was discharged for his unsuitability to military life. He then graduated from Long Beach State in 1983 with a degree in radio, TV, and film. For 2 years, he performed as a stand-up comic and hosted cable television programming while working many day jobs. Frustrated with show business, he took a temporary legit job as an emergency contracted teacher with the LA Unified School Districts. After 3 years, he moved to Arizona, where he continued teaching secondary school. He was hired to host, write, produce, and host educational television programming for Educational Management Group. 3 years later, the company went under, and he then returned to teaching. He did continue to do contract writing, and in 2008, he began to write mostly true, mostly biographical, sometimes very humorous stories. He published The Eight-Fingered Criminal Son in 2012, and then The Spirit Guide Bar this year. He then retired from teaching in June to continue writing. This one-year legit gig turned out to be a 25-year teaching career. His next book is called Teacher, Confessions of a Reluctant Educator, and will be released next year. I'm very pleased to welcome to the show William Snyder. Hi, Bill. How are you doing today?
Great, great. Thanks for having me. I'm very excited. 1 million, 1 million listeners? That's intimidating.
Well, it's, actually, it's 1.7. If you really
okay.
want to count, if you want to count them all.
now I'm really intimidated.
No. Actually, I love doing the show. It's just like having a phone conversation, and I love meeting new people. You were recommended to me by a wonderful friend of mine, Curtis Kessinger, and he has spoken so highly of you. Let's start going back and talking about what it was like growing up in Hawthorne, California, with a single mom.
Well, Hawthorne was a working-class town, not far from LAX, I suppose mm-hmm. you could say, near the beach communities. Mm-hmm. It was a great, great place to grow up. The ocean was a big part of growing up. Surfing, everybody was a surfer except for me. Never really quite learned to surf. I didn't like eating sand, but I did actually buy a surfboard for $5 from a kid down the street. It didn't have a fin, but I would paddle out and just kind of splash around for uh-huh. a couple hours and wait for pretty girls to show up on the beach and then emerge from the water. It's heroic as was possible with my 6'2", 100-pound physique.
Now, what was it like with having the Beach Boys in the neighborhood? I bet that was a pretty exciting thing, wasn't it?
They're a generation older than me, so I never I delivered bottled water to Brian Wilson many years later, but he was in one of his catatonic stages, and he didn't seem to be very aware of what was going on around him. But that's the closest I actually got to a real live Beach Boy. But they were legendary in Hawthorne, especially being a beach related community, and everybody always talked about the Beach Boys. And you know, there were rumors that the Beach Boys were going to play the prom all 4 years that I went to school there. So they never did.
They never showed up, yeah.
They never showed, no. They never showed.
That doesn't surprise me. Now, your first book is called Eternal Son, and I think we need to explain. I've started to read your book. I love it. It's a very amusing, mostly true stories, I understand. Tell us how you, the origin of the eight-fingered criminal son, where did that title come from?
Well, first of all, you got me blushing over here. So, my father, there were actually two stories. My father actually was in and out of the big house as I was growing up. I called the book The Eight-Finger Criminal Son, but he was pretty much absent from my life as I was growing up. I did have a relationship with him off and on, the absence was deafening, so that was a big part of my childhood, mm-hmm. was not having a father there. Anyway, getting back to the fingers, he was missing two fingers on one hand, and I kind of went back and forth on what to title the book. You know, uh-huh. if I had called it what would that be, the six-fingered criminal son, because really we have four fingers and two thumbs.
Right.
Right, so it's kind of confusing. Eight finger, does that mean that, you know, you had eight fingers on one hand? I settled on the eight-finger criminal son and let the confusion just live with it. But okay. At any rate, there were two stories. Uh-huh. There was the one story, my mother always said that it was some sort of a machine shop accident. Uh-huh. But my uncles told me that it was something more nefarious, that he got in trouble with the wrong people, and it was some kind of a lesson. And I don't know which is true. He's not around anymore. And mm-hmm. I think I prefer the story where the bad guys got a hold of him, though.
Oh, yeah. It's much more mysterious. You did write in the book about he did show up one day with a fantastic car. And he said that that's what the two fingers went to pay for, something like that. Wasn't that how it went?
Right. So, and again, my mother would have said that that was because of the money that he got from the insurance company for the accident. And my uncles would have said that it was some kind of a deal that he worked out that ended up making some dangerous people angry, I guess you could say.
Now, was it difficult growing up with the fact that your father had been in the big house? Did your friends know about it? Did the people talk about it in front of you? How did that play out in your life?
You know, it's funny. No, people didn't know outside of the family that he was in and out of prison. As a matter of fact, I didn't find out until I was in high school. Apparently, I had been taken to visit him when I was very young, but I have no recollection of that. But he took me, he came into town for a couple of weeks at one point when I was, I think, a freshman in high school, and explained to me that, you know, his absence was largely due to the fact that he was in and out of prison. So,
oh, wow. That must have been a tough thing to hear, or did you suspect it all along?
No, I really didn't quite know what the situation was, and you know, I had a grandfather. My grandfather lived in the apartment behind us, and you know, there were neighbors, men on the street, who kind of, you know, took me under their wing. And I really, you know, I think as a kid, didn't really understand what I was missing as far as a father goes. I did, you know, went to Catholic school, and this was in the '60s. So I think there was one kid whose father was a POW in Vietnam. That was much more exciting and interesting. But there were only two of us that didn't, you know, out of the 60 kids in my grade who didn't have fathers in the home. But again, you know, if it's what you know, you really don't think much about it. And you don't realize what's going on, you know, psychologically deep inside.
Were you an only child?
No, I had a sister. My sister was my mother, my sister. And then my grandfather lived in the back apartment.
Okay. And did your mother ever remarry?
Nope. She was a hardcore Catholic, and according to the church, you know, when you got divorced, and that was it. So she did not.
Well, I grew up in a Catholic family, and both my grandmothers kind of basically kicked my grandfathers out. But they never divorced them, you know, because they were exactly what you said, hardcore Catholics, and divorce was unheard of. It was quite, no one did it. And if you did it, you were very ashamed of it at that time.
I guess hardcore is kind of a harsh way to put it now that I think about it. And you know, as you know, everybody was a hardcore Catholic. If you were a Catholic, it, you know, was all the way. You know, there wasn't any middle ground. You know, in the 60s.
Oh, yeah. It was a rigid religion. Mm-hmm. You know, we're going to take a break and hear about your host right now. And when we come back with Bill, we're going to talk about his love-hate relationship with the Catholic Church and my love-hate relationship with the Catholic Church. We'll be right back with Bill Snyder. Have you ever met someone who was unforgettable? Someone who has touched your heart and soul? People who have faced difficult problems? People who fearlessly shared their stories? People who have priceless personalities? I've been fortunate to host a talk show called January Jones Sharing Success Stories, and it's been my privilege to interview hundreds of guests. In my new ebook, we're talking about people dealing with problems such as incest, molestation, child abuse, drug abuse, and even polygamy. Then there are my guests dealing with physical struggles such as blindness, cancer, and birth defects. All of my guests have been exciting, eclectic, and energizing. I look forward to sharing them with you in my new ebook, Priceless Personalities: Success Stories Shared by January Jones. The introductory offer of $4.99 is now available at Amazon.com. Order it today. Welcome back with my guest, William Snyder. And Bill has written two books, The Eight-Fingered Criminal Son and The Spirit Guide Bar. Now, Bill, let's talk a little bit about your recollections of what it was like growing up in the Catholic Church. Did you go to Catholic school?
I did. First through eighth grade, I was an altar boy, the whole nine yards. So I was very Catholic as a young boy.
And
the nuns and
Yeah, that's exactly the way I was raised. I went to Catholic school for 12 years. Well, actually 13 with kindergarten, and then I went to Catholic college. Now, you have a love-hate relationship. Yeah. Can you talk about a little bit about your feelings about it now that you're an adult and you're writing about it?
Okay. Well, I'm no longer a practicing Catholic, and I didn't choose to raise my children Catholic. But when I think back, some of the things with the nuns, they could be a lot of the nuns that I had as a kid were mean when you look back at it, they mm-hmm. they'd smack you. I remember I wore a crew cut because I had this one nun who would pick me up out of my desk by my hair. whenever I would, I think this was before ADD. And I think if I were growing up in these days, I probably would have been diagnosed with ADD. But, the Catholic Church or Catholic school had a real good answer for ADD, and that was nuns. If you didn't sit still, they'd let you have it.
I remember that so well. And, actually, when I look back on it, they really were tough on the boys and not so much the girls. The girls kind of just sat back and watched the whole thing unfold. But I can remember boys getting their heads banged against the blackboard and they really took it. Those were times I was so glad I wasn't a boy.
And I'll tell you, my first nun, Sister Rose Michael, had her first and second grade, and she was, the real life version of Julie Andrews. I mean, she was from Wyoming and she did rope tricks and she'd throw a rope on you around you when she wanted to bring you up to the desk, and she sang and she had the guitar, and she was really sweet. I don't ever remember getting whacked by her. but then third grade, I had Sister Claudia, and she was a mean nun, and she used to tell us these scary stories. In fact, there's a story in the book, The Eight-Fingered Criminal Son, that she used to tell us about growing up in Boston, Massachusetts, and there was a snowball fight, and the kid who started it really got what he deserved because somebody tagged him in the side of the head with a snowball, and his eyeball came flying out. It was hanging by a string, and he had to run home with his eyeball hanging from the 2-foot string, and all I could think was, if your eyeball was hanging out from the 2-foot string, would you see, what that eyeball was seeing? And could you hold it behind your head and see what was going on behind you? And, she really creeped us all out. But it's funny, I was doing a reading in L.A. Last summer, I think it was. Mm-hmm. And there was a girl that I went to school with who showed up, and she brought her mother, and her mother was a volunteer at the Catholic school, and she was a good friend of Sister Claudia. And she said that Sister Claudia used to come into the lunchroom and just laugh about how she, creeped us all out with her scary stories and how she scared us. And so,
I love about that story is you kids were all in Southern California, and there was not going to be any snowball fights in your neighborhood, was there?
No, but she definitely let us know. That was her cautionary tale about throwing snowballs.
And don't you think it's interesting how all these years later, we all can remember the names of the nuns? It's like unforgettable personalities that you've met, and they just stick with you for your entire life. It's always amazes me how everyone could just reel off the names of all the sisters they had, good, bad, and the ugly.
it's funny. I just called her Sister Claudia. That was a real name in the book. I called her Sister Agnes because we went
smart.
Through and changed all the names of anybody that we might, Sister Claudia would be about 175 years old if she were alive today. So I don't think we'd insult her, but at any rate, I changed her name.
Don't worry, my listeners and I, we're used to keeping secrets, so there's no problem there.
Okay, great. If she's still walking around, don't tell her.
I will. She probably won't be listening to this show. So tell us about your background as a writer. When did you start writing? Did you keep a journal when you were a kid, or how did you become a writer?
Yeah, the nuns got me started writing, actually. I've always loved writing stories. I can still remember my very first story. In fact, I think I've got it somewhere in that scrapbook my mother kept for me. It was a play, and it was a complete ripoff of Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. It was Santa and Mike the Mouse, and it was the flying mouse. You know, a flying mouse, Mighty Mouse, who saved Christmas, just like Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer did. And I got a bunch of kids together, and we did a play, and I was just always. I was always writing stories, I think back, here's one that got the nuns upset. It was at Easter time, and we had to write a story about Jesus. And I wrote a story where the apostles got together, and they slaughtered all the Romans and saved Jesus. And got him away. So I had to go talk to Monsignor Reda and the head of the church, and when he got me by himself, he laughed and he said it was a pretty good story, but that, you know, that's not what Jesus had in mind. And,
I love it.
Originally went to college for radio, TV, and film, mm-hmm. and started writing screenplays, mm-hmm. and did some educational television work for that 3-year stint that you mentioned earlier. So I wrote a lot of educational television programs. But I just, there was something inside me that I needed to bring out, and I knew it. And I read Stephen King's On Writing. I don't know if you're familiar with the book, but it's the best book about writing that I've ever read. And he had you could break the whole book down to two pieces of advice. He said, okay. If you want to write, you gotta read good books, and you gotta read authors that speak to you, that you feel an attachment to. You want to read authors that you'd want to emulate, not copy straight out, but emulate, mm-hmm. be like. Mm-hmm. And then he said, you have to write, and you can't give yourself any excuses though. You don't write for an hour, you don't write for 4 hours. You give yourself a word count. And if it's 500 words a day, if it's 1,000 words a day, 2,000 words a day, whatever it is, you give yourself a word count, and you don't get up from the computer until you've done it.
Okay, and, that's great advice. Great advice.
It was very good advice.
Now, are you a morning writer or a nighttime writer? What time of the day do you write?
Yeah, I'm probably not a nighttime writer. I'm not a nighttime anything. I get up really early in the morning. I've always been an early riser, and I seem to function a lot better in the morning. Getting back to talking about the Stephen King's On Writing, though, as a teacher for 20, at that point, I've been teaching, I guess, about 20 years, 18 years, and I've been keeping a journal because I knew I wanted to write about my teaching experiences. And at that, I think right now I've got a stack of journals that's probably about 4 or 5 feet high. So I just started going through the journals and reading them at night, and then I went to the library because my computer was busted. I had the summer off. I took the summer off from teaching where I didn't do any summer school. And the library is kind of an annoying place, you know. It's supposed to be quiet, but you got kids running around and babies crying and guys talking on their cell phones, and you know, it can get real annoying. So that seemed to help for some reason. It helped me to focus on what I needed to do so I could get out of there and get my 2,000 words. And the other interesting thing that happened that summer was I had intended to write about teaching, and I kept coming up with these stories about childhood that come up in The Eight-Fingered Criminal Son. And that's one of the things I really love about writing, is sometimes the writing takes control. There's something mystical, there's something mysterious that happens. And you think you're going to write one thing, and the writing has a whole other idea.
I know. So I've had that happen to me, and I just get such an adrenaline rush when I write. Sometimes yeah. I get so into it, I lose track of time. And what your advice is wonderful, because I have so many listeners who email and send me questions about writing. And I basically say the same thing. Don't talk about being a writer. You have to sit down and become a writer. And the only way you do that is by writing 2,000 words a day. That's a great number. That's a difficult number to reach, but if you've got the flow going, it's probably an easy number. Don't you agree?
Well, sometimes I think I wrote some junk. There's some stories that I wrote over the course. I wrote 60 or 70 stories over the course of that summer. But the bottom line is, I wrote, and I don't buy that business of writer's block. I hear people talk about writer's block, and I can't write, or I have to write at this time, or I was a basketball player when I was in high school, and they talked about shooting slumps when your shot was off. The only way to get through a shooting slump was to just keep shooting. And I feel like it's that way with writing, and so what if you have to wander through some muck and you have to write some lousy prose before you get to the good stuff? You have to power through. That's the way I feel.
Oh, yeah, that everyone goes through that, and everyone knows exactly what you're saying. When you read some of your stuff, you go back and you think, oh, my God, this is just horrible, horrible stuff. And then occasionally you'll find something that you actually like. We're going to take a break now and hear from one of my sponsors. And when we come back with Bill Snyder, I want to talk briefly about what you taught in school and about your career as a stand-up comic, where you met Curtis Kissinger. And then when we come back, I would like you to share your website information and share with my listeners how they can get your books. We'll be right back with Bill Snyder.
Could your commute or daily exercise routine use a boost? When was the last time you really got the giggles? This is Adele Park, author of Yikes, Another Quirky Audiobook, inviting you to tune in, turn on, and let loose a few good laughs. Yikes, Another Quirky Audiobook is about a marijuana enthusiast named Blue McKenna who gets involved in a reality TV show as a way to cure an apocalyptic case of writer's block. A conglomerate of kooky contestants invades the polygamous community of Naval, Utah to compete in a reality show called Yikes. Things get sticky when Blue McKenna's hemp garden is ignited during an ill-fated seance. Find out what's going down in the desert in Yikes, Another Quirky Audiobook. Visit www.yikesaudiobook.com to learn more. That's www.yikesaudiobook.com.
I've enjoyed both of Adele's books, Yikes and Jitters. I highly recommend them, and she's won several awards. She's a brilliant writer. And speaking of brilliant writers, we have Bill Snyder with us today. Bill, could you share your website information and share with my listeners how they can get your books?
Great. Thank you. It's www.williamsnyder.biz. That's my website. That's B-I-Z. Mm-hmm. And then my books are available on Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com. I've got a favorite bookstore. If you're in L.A., I don't know how many of your listeners are. Well, you've got millions of them. I'm sure there's some in L.A.
the Book
not
many.
In Rolling Hills. Frog in Rolling Hills, California. I want to get in a plug for my buddy at the Book Frog.
Wonderful.
That's where I do my readings in Los Angeles. The ebook is only $3. That's for both the Eight Finger Criminal Son and the Spirit Guide Bar. And then I think the bound copies are about $10.
Oh, wonderful. Now, what kind of teaching did you do for 25 years? Did you teach English? Did you teach writing?
I was a terrible teacher. No. Hopefully I wasn't a terrible teacher. I think when I started, I didn't know a heck of a lot about what I was doing. But by the end, I think I learned a thing or two. But yes, I was an English teacher for the most part. And I also taught creative writing. Really enjoyed teaching creative writing. And I was also an academic decathlon coach for the past 6 years.
Oh, fantastic. That's amazing.
Are you familiar with academic decathlon?
Oh, Yeah, well, I am. I don't know if that's just in California, but we raised our daughters. Well, I didn't raise them Catholic, but I did, speaking of great educations, I did send them all to Catholic, all-girls Catholic high school, and they really did get fantastic educations, and they were on the decathlon teams. That's a fantastic experience for the kids and for the coaches too, isn't it?
It really is. You know, every year it's something different. I think last year it was Russia. Dr. Zhivago was the book. Oh.
Wow.
you gotta really love literature to enjoy Dr. Zhivago. Another year it was the Civil War, and the book was The Red Cat, Badge of Courage, and the Great Depression, Grapes of Wrath. So it was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed teaching academic decathlon. But
Bill, share with my listeners what it is in case they're not familiar with the decathlon teams.
Well, it's centered around a topic. As I said, last year was I'm trying to think of what this year is, but last year it was Russia and the Cold War, and there are 10 different events. So every student makes a speech, which is a lot of fun, and they can make a speech about anything, and they give the speech in front of a three-person panel, and they're judged and critiqued, and then they do an interview with a three-person panel. And then there are different events. There's mathematics, there's science. So since the topic was Russia, it was the space race. There's art, and it was all Russian art, and music was all Russian music, and history. Again, history, I think, was the Cold War. So at any rate, there are 10 different topics, including the speech and the interview. And it really makes it, you know, if a student participates in academic decathlon for 4 years, it makes for a real well-rounded student.
Oh, yeah. And it's like a year-long project, and it's just an amazing program. I know that, and then the families go, and it's like cheering for your football team because everyone gets so excited, and it's so very, very competitive. It's fantastic. Now, let's just change the topic a little bit, and let's talk about your career in stand-up comedy. How long did you do that, and did you enjoy it?
Oh, well, that's how I met your buddy, Curtis Kessinger, of course. I've known Curtis for 20-something years. I don't even want to think about how far that goes back. But I guess it was the like to say my wife gets really upset when I say this, but we did a lot of comedy in the 80s, but now we don't care what the temperature is. Okay.
Okay. Yeah. I can see why she gets upset.
And I also say that I did stand-up comedy for 2 years. It was 2 years because it took me 2 years to figure out the jokes were supposed to be funny.
Okay, gotcha. Well, you know, you're a very funny writer, but you know, I've had other comics on the show, and I actually did try a little class in stand-up comedy just so I'd get a feel for what it's like. Quite frankly, it can be terrifying, can't it be?
It was I was a class clown. I think Curtis was a class camp clown. I think, you know, a lot of people who end up doing it, you know, started out as class clowns. And, you know, I think Curtis was ahead of me. He went further than I did. He was, he performed at the Comedy Store and, the Improv, and, he was kind of in with the, he progressed a little further than I did. I spent most of my time doing dive clubs. and if I did get into a better club, it was at the end of the night with a few drunks yelling and screaming, you know, trying to overpower them.
How long was your routine? How long did you have to stand up and entertain for?
I think the longest I ever did was a 20-minute set. Usually it was five to 10 minutes. But I'll tell you, you know, hanging out with Curtis Kessinger and some of the other comics, we did run into some of the more big name people. And I remember there was a night Roseanne Barr, who nobody knew who she was, showed up at the Comedy Store, And she sat down at our table and she drank one of the guy's beers. And we thought she just wandered in off the street. You know, she was wearing a man's flannel and she said, "Hey, you guys, I'm going to be on Johnny Carson tomorrow night." And we thought she was a nutcase. And then they called her up and she just destroyed the place. She was hilarious. And then sure enough, she was on Johnny Carson the next night.
It was
a fun time. There were, you know, a lot of great comics were just getting started. Andrew Dice Clay comes to mind. Damon and Keenan Wayans come to mind. Rodney Dangerfield was performing a lot back then. Andrew Dice Clay. So it was a blast just being, you know, being involved around those really talented people. But I think Curtis and I both had the same feeling about going on the road, though. Going on the road is real tough. And I was getting married. And, you know, my father-in-law asked me what my job, or at the time, what are you doing for a living? Well, how much do you make as a stand-up comic? You know, well, I make my money waitering at night. And I said, no, I think you need to get a job. And so that's how I ended up taking that 1 year contract as a teacher that stretched out to a 25-year contract.
Oh, wow. That's such a great career to look back on. Yeah. I mean, teaching is just such a fantastic thing. I had always planned to be a teacher and I never quite did it. And I was more interested in becoming a history teacher because, like you, I like biographies. I like real life stories. I'm not so much into fiction because I feel real life is probably more unbelievable than any fiction you'll ever read. Don't you agree?
Real life is more unbelievable than fiction. Say that again.
Yeah.
Real life is more unbelievable than fiction. That's right. Truth is stranger than fiction.
Right, exactly. That's what I meant to say.
No, that's what you said. That's what you said. Yeah, I'd agree with that. And I think fiction, for the most part, derives from truth, doesn't it? You know? But I'm with you. I think if I'd had my choice, I'd have preferred teaching history. I love history myself.
Yeah. Well, you know, your stories are very personal, and you dig deep to share things, and that's very difficult to do. I love your stories, and I love the way you find humor in most every situation. I think that's a secret to being a survivor. Don't you agree?
Yeah, I think, and thank you, by the way. Growing up, I think in a situation where, I was, the only kid with a single mother, and I was a dork before they were calling people dorks. I think I was in the eighth grade. I think I mentioned this before, I was 6'2", and I weighed 100 pounds, and I had the coordination of a tangled garden hose. So I learned to make fun of myself, to use self-deprecating humor. To deflect, anything that anybody else had to say. So I could beat them to the punch, and that worked real well for me.
I think a lot of kids, that's how they become comics and they become writers. And I think a lot of it is a survival instinct, and it's a very healthy thing to do. You know, we're going to take a break and hear from one of my sponsors. When we come back, Bill, I want you to talk a little bit about how you came about to write the Spirit Guide Bar. And also, we're going to talk about what success means to you, your future book, and if you have any regrets or advice for our listeners. We'll be right back with the brilliant William Snyder.
Second time around can be better. Second timers try harder. Looking to have a rewarding second marriage? Any marriage. Read Successful Second Marriages by Patricia Bubash. She interviews a variety of couples that have succeeded in their second attempt. Each story reflects that the second marriages can be tough going, yet be the best of the best. Learn from these couples who share their intimate stories, how they struggled with difficulty and have thrived. Stories such as, "Our kids drove us apart. We separated 5 times in 4 years. 4 months into our marriage, my 85-year-old father-in-law came to live with us. 1 year into our marriage, I was diagnosed legally blind. Death of my eldest child brought grief, depression into our new marriage." Successful Second Marriages is encouraging, hopeful, inspiring. Available on Amazon.com in book form and ebook. Read Pat's musings at www.successfulsecondmarriages.com.
Pat's book is fantastic, and I'm in a second marriage of 43 years. I highly recommend Second Marriage and Pat's book. Right now, we're with Bill Snyder. Now, Bill, share with us how you came about to write the Spirit Guide Bar and the transcendental experience you had that created this book.
Well, great. Yeah, the Spirit Guide Bar, you want to talk about a personal book. That's I had some friends do some pre-reading of the book, and ask me, you know, are you sure you really want to publish this thing? You really got some personal stuff about yourself and your family in there. And, I had my sister read it, and she said, yeah, go ahead and publish it. And, it was a book that I really wasn't sure if this book was just for me or something that I wanted to publish. But at any rate, it started out a formulaic It's a Wonderful Life type story. It was I was going to write a book on a character based on me, and I seemed to keep coming back to myself in my writing. And he's a disillusioned high school teacher who's struggling financially with his family, or to support his family, and he ends up going back to the Catholic Church and praying for some help, and an angel shows up with a suitcase full of money. And my idea was this guy was going to take the money and just totally destroy his life, having an affair on his wife and getting into gambling. And a year later, the police show up to take him off, and he says, I just want my life back. And he ends up back in the church. Well, that was the idea.
Okay.
As I said earlier, sometimes the story took over, and it just kept coming back to me. This was a period in my life where I think I was starting to realize that I was going to have to do something else besides teaching. And I was just getting frustrated with teaching. Teaching's changing an awful lot. Education's changing an awful lot. And I had my character. Who ended up becoming me. I think, what was I calling him? Jack Sullivan, I think was the name I had for him. Take a hike up South Mountain. You're not too far from Phoenix. You might have heard of South Mountain. He decides after teaching Thoreau and Emerson, I want to have a transcendentalist experience. And so I hike to the top of the mountain, find a little secret valley, do some breathing, meditating, I guess you could say, and it happens. The transcendental experience comes through. I meet my spirit guide. He takes me to the Spirit Guide Bar, which is in the side of the mountain, and Ernest Hemingway is the bartender, and the Scarecrow from The Wizard of Oz is there. And, other Richard Feynman, the physicist, is there, and Joseph Campbell, and Ulysses S. Grant, and all these characters from history keep popping up. Lee Harvey Oswald shows up at one point.
Oh my God!
So, and it's a journey into my own, into my own psyche a little bit. And I meet my father, the eight-fingered criminal son, end up having a bar fight with my father.
Wow!
The story.
Powerful stuff.
Yeah. And I get into forgiving him. It's a book about forgiving him for not being there for the family. And I also get into my mother passed away of cancer when I was in my mid-20s. And I was I didn't handle it the way that I should have handled it, that I wanted to handle it. So it also deals with me forgiving myself. And part of the book takes place in a confessional at St. Joseph's Catholic Church in Hawthorne, California, with Monsignor Redahan. So get into the issues with the Catholic Church. And somehow I think I managed to make it funny through all that. It's definitely quirky. It's definitely unusual. It's definitely a transcendentalist story. But it's also, again, very personal. It's about religion. It's about spirituality. It's about transcendentalism, and it's about forgiveness, I think.
Oh, wow. That's I can't wait to read it. And isn't it interesting that if you ever were raised in the Catholic Church or in a Catholic school, that how often in our life we go back to those same things and those lessons that we've learned there as small children stay with us forever. Don't you agree?
Absolutely. I've got a line in the book where the Monsignor in the confessional says to me, you can take Bill Snyder out of the church, but you can't take the church out of Bill Snyder. And I just, and I talk about in the book how even though I've left the church and I've got my issues with the church, when mm-hmm. other people start bad-mouthing the church, I get defensive.
To tell you
the truth, this new Pope's got me kind of excited about the church. He's got me thinking twice about my decision. I'm a big fan of this new Pope.
It's very exciting, especially for Catholics like us who have kind of fallen away from the church. I've had issues just like you. I think we all have had major issues with it. And it is exciting because he's just talking about things that were unheard of, especially his tolerance for gay people. It's going to be very interesting to watch his brain. I think it'll be probably, he'll be like a big changer like John Paul. It'll be revolutionary what he does. It is exciting. I'm very happy about that. Before we go, do you have any regrets? No, I mean, don't we all, but any you want to share?
Well, I think you can read about my regrets in the Spirit Guide bar. I've got plenty of them. But I'd say, the biggest regret in my life is the way that I handled my mother's illness when she was sick, and I think I'm not the only one who's done this. I was just I was afraid of what was going on. I didn't want to face it, and instead of being there, for those last few months with my mother, I spent a lot of time hiding. My uncle told me, my mother's brother, that you're going to have to live with this for the rest of your life. And I have. And I'll tell you, writing the book, The Spirit Guide Bar, really helped me to deal with that. Because, I know in my heart that my mother forgives me.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And so often, writing is probably the best therapy anyone could have in their life. Don't you agree?
Yeah, it's a lot cheaper. Maybe a little more time consuming, but a lot cheaper than a shrink. Right?
Yeah, yes, absolutely. And in my book, I do write personal things too. And it is so difficult to dig deep down there and to put it on paper. And then it's even more difficult to make the decision to share it. I think it's a wonderful thing that you were able to do that. I know how difficult it is to do. I think that your books are fantastic. I hope you will come back. I want you definitely to come back when Teacher, Confessions of a Reluctant Educator is released next year. Will you do that?
Absolutely. Thank you so much. I'm excited already.
Me too. I can't wait. Well, actually, I can't wait to read The Spirit Guide, and I'm looking forward to your next book. You're a wonderful writer. To my listeners, we hope you've enjoyed this wonderful show today. My upcoming guests for the rest of the week will amaze, amuse, and they will astonish you, just like Bill did today. This is the show where you hear inspiring information that will help you to become successful too. And if you're a writer, Bill and I both suggest you better sit down and just start writing. I would love to welcome you to our wonderful No Whining world. I love sharing our stories, struggles, and our secrets for success. It's our hope that we can encourage all of our listeners to emulate our guests today and every day. Now, remember my mantra, if you think it, then you can do it. So for now, dear friends, please stop whining and then start smiling and then start sharing our show with everyone you know. And if that doesn't work, then start eating chocolate, lots and lots of chocolate. Again, thank you to my wonderful guest, Bill Snyder. We look forward to having you back on the show. This is January Jones thanking you for joining me today on my journey and reminding you to take care and stay safe. Thank you.
We want to thank you for listening to January Jones Sharing Success Story. Always remember Ms. Jones' personal mantra, if you can think it, you can do it. That's what all of our guests have done with their lives, and so can you. You are the ultimate success coach in your own life. All you need to do will be to start sharing your own story with your family and friends. We hope that our guest stories will encourage you to explore an equation in your future that will combine your creativity, plus connecting with others will enable you to be successful too. Always remember, your passion plus your purpose will equal prosperity as you explore the wonderful world of January Jones.